No one takes credit for inventing the phrase "the personal is political." It has become ubiquitous and axiomatic.
Today, we explore politics and the personal subjects of drugs, bathrooms, and birth.
This is Sarah from the left.
And Beth from the right.
You're listening to Pantsuit Politics.
No shouting, no insults, plenty of nuance.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design, thoughtful construction, and little details that make life in your space easier. And now they're bringing that comfort and style outside with their outdoor collection. Burrow's outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry stain-resistant foam cushions. As always, you get free shipping on every order. Get 15% off at burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
So that I do not like to spend my time or money in salons when I can help it, but I do enjoy a good manicure, and I especially enjoy spending time with my daughters doing the Olive and June Mani system at home, because we can all get a good looking manicure for around $2. We know that the polish won't chip and will last at least a full week. We get to await with anticipation the new colors that come out each season. The girls love being able to add some sparkles or choose whether they want their top coat to be matte or shiny. We just have a really good time together with salon grade tools that are so easily explained so that we can do a really good job taking care of our nails, but do it all from the comfort at home. All the choices of a big salon stored in a basket in my closet for when we're ready to hang out together. The Olive and June Mani system is a real game changer. So visit oliveandjune.com/pantsuit for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/pantsuit for 20% off your first Mani system.
Before we get started on this episode, here's a message from our sponsor. Happy to be back. We've got lots of interesting feedback about our ACA discussion and what shapes today's episodes, where we're going to talk about some personal, semi-healthcare related issues, but just the idea that many issues that we feel are totally personal have a lot of political aspects to them. Before we get started, we really want to encourage everyone to leave us iTunes reviews. If you have a chance, you guys are amazing at them and they're always so wonderful to read. So if you have a second, it's not going to lie, it's not the most intuitive process, but if you can hop over to iTunes and leave our podcast a review, we'd be greatly appreciated.
I'm so tired of talking about bathrooms, Sarah. I just feel like, when are we going to stop talking about bathrooms? But here we are again. This week, in addition to the challenge that Loretta Lynch is mounting to North Carolina's law, the Obama administration issued some guidance to schools on their transgender restroom policies, and drama ensued.
Of course. I posted a really wonderful article on my Facebook page that I will share in the show notes called Seven Things I'm Learning About Transgender Persons from Baptist News Global, which I wasn't expecting. But it was a really great opinion piece written by Mark Wingfield. And I think he did a really good job of tackling the bathroom issue and the transgender thing. And, you know, I told my husband, I'm understanding of the fact that it's at first I was, the way I felt was, we're sort of what you brought up. We're tackling all this very quickly. And the idea of transgender and the idea that gender is a spectrum and not this binary situation, we're sort of foisting this on all on our culture very quickly. But then, you know, I was reading this article and thinking through some things. And the truth is, in the same way we did not invent homosexuality in the 80s and 90s when it, you know, this movement really took hold, we are not inventing the idea that gender biologically and otherwise is a spectrum right now. This is a, you know, there are real, speaking of healthcare, there are real issues and real biological realities with regards to ambiguous sexual anatomy and chromosomes and, you know, all these things. They've been around since the beginning of the human experience. And just because right now we, the government, is sort of stepping in and making clear that you may not discriminate someone based on this, these biological realities, like, this isn't some sort of cultural movement being forced on people. I think it's a discussion coming around some real biological realities for people. And also, my husband is an attorney for a school board, and he says, like, the official thing from the Obama administration is sort of new, but these guidelines have been in place, and there was a couple lower court decisions that have been in place for a while giving school boards these kind of loose, or not loose, these guidelines regarding how to treat transgendered students. So, I mean, I think it continued to, it sort of, it heightened the passion of the conversation, but the reality of the situation is not that different, despite the Obama administration's very vocal, I don't want to use the word, vocal and supportive guidelines, I guess is what I'll say.
Well, you know where I am on the substance of this. I mean, I can't think of a thing that's less my business than where someone decides to use the bathroom. And I think this is much ado about nothing. We just need to respect how people self-identify. Politically, I find it a little bit confusing because this is certainly the kind of thing that riles the conservative base. I think it's an awkward time for Hillary Clinton, for the Obama administration to be going to something that is so thought of as a state's rights kind of territory. Like, the idea of local schools getting guidance from the Department of Justice on their bathrooms, like, that's a big deal. And I, even though I happen to agree with what that guidance is, I think that it's weird to me that they're doing this right now. It's weird to me that they're doing this, the deportations that are coming up. I'm kind of like, what's going on in the West Wing right now?
Yeah. I mentioned this before. I think a lot of it is people felt, you know, many people, especially the sort of Democrat establishment, was on the wrong side of history for too long with marriage equality. And I think this is just, we're not going to do it this time. We're not going to be on the wrong time this time.
Yeah, but if I were Hillary Clinton, I might be like, hey, y'all, I got this, but don't make it harder for me to, you know, move in and take care of these things.
Yeah, but I mean, that's the exact calculation people get onto her about. So I think it's fine if they're doing this, and, you know, I think it's the right thing to do. And if it makes it tougher for her, it does, but it's the right thing to do and it needs to happen. And we all need to become much more comfortable with the idea that sexuality is a spectrum and gender is a spectrum. And what I was thinking about today when I was thinking about the transgendered guidelines and the bathroom hubbub was, I think what needs to be said when I have conversations with people, and I'm not sure I'm always the best at saying it or making this point, but when we allow more room for different understandings of what it means to be a man and what it means to be a woman, that is just as beneficial for people adopting a more traditional idea of what it means to be a man and be a woman as it is for people pushing the boundaries of what that gender identity can mean. And what I mean is, you know, as someone who is raising three boys, I think a lot about sort of the traditional ideas of masculinity. Even as someone who, you know, fulfills a lot of traditional gender roles with regards to, you know, being the primary caregiver at home and all these things, you know, I want more room in my boys' life for if they decide to become sort of the traditional idea of quote unquote what it means to be a man, even within that identity, to allow a little more space and a little more understanding for people who, you know, maybe aren't traditionally minded, but also just, I don't know, just a little breathing room for everyone. Sort of what all the single ladies, when we had her on to talk about the book, just let's just allow a little more space for how people become who they are and their understanding of what that means. And I think we'll all be happier. I really do.
Well, I don't know that we're going to get everyone to gender and sexuality or spectrums, but I think there's an interesting conversation to be had about sort of what the federal jurisdiction is over our school systems around topics like this, because this really pushes the question of, are we talking civil rights or not, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you and I think that we are. There are certainly people who think that there is a countervailing privacy interest, and we've kind of talked to death the fact that we don't buy that, but it's an interesting conversation and an interesting time for it.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, guess what? Congress did something on a bipartisan basis. You want to talk about that?
I know. I heard. It's so exciting.
So after 3 years of work, Congress passed the Comprehensive Addiction and Recovery Act. The Senate passed this 94-1.
Who was the one?
You know what? I didn't even look that up because I was just so happy to see the 94-1.
They better have been absent or something.
Yeah, I'm hoping. And then, well, no, I would think that the 5 unaccounted for votes would be absences. I don't know who the one is. The House passed it 400-5. I do know that included in that 5 is Thomas Massie of Kentucky, which I wasn't real pleased to see. We'll post articles about this in the show notes, but this legislation is intended to combat the heroin and opioid addiction real epidemic that's sweeping the country. And, you know, it's the statistics on this are astonishing to me. The number of people dying every day. The way this problem seems to know no geographic or socioeconomic or other limits. And so I'm happy that Congress has tried to do something. I'm happy that they didn't let perfect get in the way of progress. There's certainly criticism of this act. It doesn't go far enough. It doesn't provide enough funding, whatever. But we have some new grant programs that have been created, some new studies that have been authorized. So I'm encouraged that this happened.
Well, and what I thought was interesting is that this came out right around the time that the LA Times just released an investigation into OxyContin and the pharmaceutical. I forgot which company it is, actually, that that manufactures OxyContin. I'll have to look that up, and I'll leave the investigation in the show notes. But basically, OxyContin has always been pushed as 12-hour, sort of what made it famous was 12-hour pain relief, and they've known from the beginning that it doesn't give 12-hour pain relief. And so they either were pushing the doctors to increase the dosage or to and like telling their reps, like tell them to increase the dosage, or basically just, you know, just denying over and over again that it didn't actually provide 12-hour pain relief, which if you're giving people stronger dosages, or they're thinking it's supposed to last for 12 hours and it doesn't, then they're not dosing appropriately, so they're crashing with an opiate is such a dangerous situation generally, but also leads to bottoming out that can contribute to addiction in real, real ways. And so, I mean, it was really my eye-opening to me because I thought, you know, so you hear the phrase like genetic creates the gun of addiction and environment pulls the trigger. And so I always thought like, well, maybe people who are getting OxyContin were already prone, or they were having a tough time in life, or no, maybe it was just that the drug company knew the dosage could lead to addiction. And there was really no other indication that this person was prone to addiction or would have problems. And I just think about all the people who suffered under this drug, people who have died addicted to this drug, or, you know, that led to heroin addiction, all these things. And I think it's just so, so despicable.
There is more legislation pending in the House, and I think some concern that we'll see a little chipping away at the good that's been done here and some bureaucracy added. So we'll see where this goes. Rand Paul also has legislation pending around a drug that is used to treat heroin addiction. And it's a drug that's being used right now, but there are some severe limitations on prescribing the drug. And I think his legislation is about chipping away at those limitations so that the drug can be used more prevalently. Living in an area that is really under siege from heroin, you know, I am supportive of any efforts to get more people in treatment in the most effective ways possible. We are right along a major interstate here in Cincinnati, and it's just unbelievable to me the amount of drugs coming into the state of Kentucky from this area. And something has to be done, and, you know, I don't know. I think it has to be hit at all levels because this is not a local problem. It is a local problem, but it's not just a local problem, right? So we have local governments working on this. I hope that the Kentucky State Legislature will take a break from, you know, wanting to kill each other and do something about this that's productive on the state level. But I'm happy to see, this is one instance where I'm happy to see the federal government taking some action, because I think this is a federal problem.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the last thing I wanted to bring up is marijuana, you know, since we're on the drug kick. The Ninth Circuit is considering a law that was also passed with bipartisan sponsorship that prevents the Department of Justice from using their funding to prosecute people who are in compliance with state medical marijuana laws. If you'll recall, we're still in the bizarro world of the federal government saying that marijuana is illegal and certain states saying, not here. And even though federal law is supposed to supersede state law, we have Congress acting, at least in the medical marijuana context, to say, well, you're not going to enforce the federal law against the states. So it's a really interesting scenario, should make for an interesting opinion, especially when you think about where the Ninth Circuit is located. But it made me realize, Sarah, that we've never really talked about marijuana on the show. I wondered what your thoughts were about legalization.
Funny story on that. I side with Quiz. The only question I did not align with Hillary was marijuana. She thinks it should just be legal for medical usage, and I think it should be legal across the board.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I have no problem with marijuana. Well, my feeling about marijuana is I don't understand why you could smoke and drink but not smoke marijuana. So whatever. Godspeed. I have no problem with the legalization of marijuana.
That's kind of where I am. I mean, does it make me excited to think about marijuana stores around every corner? It does not. But in the medical context particularly, I think, why would we not use something that grows in the ground instead of something made in a laboratory?
Yep.
And then when I think about the line between medical and recreational and how artificial that will become and semi-absurd, and to your point about cigarettes and alcohol, I mean, I just think, can we just move on? But yeah. I think we should really move on, because this situation where it's legal at the state level, not at the federal level, you can have businesses in certain states, but they can't get a bank account, you know, because of the federal issues. That's dumb. And it's going to require a lot of resources and energy around something that's dumb. So, you know, have it be legal. Tax it for days if you want to, whatever. Yep. But like, let's get past it.
Yeah. Give me that tax money. I want that tax money for show.
Okay, so we always compliment the other side before we leave this section of the podcast, and my compliment today goes to Joe Donnelly, senator from Indiana, who was instrumental in the passage of the Comprehensive Addiction and Recovery Act that we were just talking about. I was particularly impressed. I caught an interview with him today, and he talked about how lovely it was to work with Kelly Ayotte, a Republican from New Hampshire. He talked about the importance of setting partisanship aside on issues that are this important to people. And side note, I think most issues are pretty important to people. So if we could do this more often, that would be cool. But he talked with such passion about addiction, invited everyone listening to the interview to be forthcoming with their families and their neighbors about addiction. He talked about the need to eliminate any stigma and just get people the help they need. He has resources on his website for people who don't know where to get help. I mean, he was obviously very passionate about this, and I was really impressed.
Yeah, that's awesome. So I thought I should compliment too. I'm going to compliment somebody from the other side of the Democratic Party, because Bernie came to Paducah, y'all. So exciting. I did not attend the rally, but he came to Paducah. I just wanted to say, thanks for stopping by, Bernie. Welcome. first of all. But to compliment the person on the Republican side, I wanted to say what a beautiful article there was recently in the New York Times about Representative, and I'm going to try to say her name correctly, Elena Rose Lehtinen. And she is a Republican out of Florida. She's also the first Latina woman represented or elected to Congress, which is sort of amazing. Not sort of amazing, all amazing. But she has a transgender son, and she's been very outspoken about supporting her son, Rodrigo, and appearing in ads by an organization called SAVE that advocates for gay and transgender rights and just really saying, you know, protecting her son, sticking up for her son and saying, you know, I loved my son as a daughter and now I love him as a man. And this is something we should all strive to understand and accept. And I just thought it was really, really awesome and amazing and brave. And so good job, Representative Rose Lehtinen. I think I said that right.
Well, continuing with our theme of the personal is political, we're going to go real personal for the suit today and address a question that we got in response to our Affordable Care Act episode and something that we've heard from a number of people about since we have started the podcast, birth.
Traditionally, financial planning advice is either only for those who are already wealthy or salespeople calling themselves financial advisors who say they'll give you free financial advice but really just sell products to earn commissions. Fearless Finance takes a dramatic departure from either of those traditional models. Their entire business is built on making financial advice accessible and affordable because we know that financial literacy, stress reduction, and financial security are critical to overall well-being. I'm a little bit obsessed with Elizabeth, our Fearless Finance advisor. I've had an array of advisors in the past who answered questions like, should we be spending less on this, with evasive answers like, it depends on your priorities. Not Elizabeth. She answers with actually helpful guidelines. You're spending more than the average family of five, or I'd like to see this increase by 6%. Thank you. This is Fearless Finance's mission, to make advice affordable and accessible. You meet with your planner virtually and they charge you by the hour. You only pay for the time you use down to a quarter hour. Their planners meet with you where you are on your financial journey, no judgment. Visit fearlessfinance.com today. You can chat with a planner for free to make sure it's a good fit, and you'll get $50 off your first planning meeting when you use the code PANTSUIT. That's fearlessfinance.com and use code PANTSUIT for $50 off your first planning meeting.
We're finally at my favorite time of year. Spring is here. Summer is just around the corner. We're getting our summer essentials ready, our sunscreen, our emotional support water bottles, our steamy beach reeds. But maybe you would prefer your steamy earbuds. This year, there is a new kind of essential right at your fingertips. Enemies to love, chance encounters, a slow burn, friends that become more. Whatever your favorite romantic trope, Dipsy has a spicy audio story just for you. Dipsy is an app full of hundreds of short and spicy audio stories that bring scenarios to life with immersive soundscapes and realistic characters. You can discover stories about second chance romances and adventurous vacation flings. That's my favorite. Hot and heavy hookups. It can be as heavy or as light as you want it to be. This is what I love about Dipsy. It is a modern approach to romance through high quality, captivating audio fiction that you can listen to in the privacy of your own headphones. For listeners of the show, Dipsy is offering an extended 30-day free trial when you go to dipsystories.com/pantsuit. That's 30 days of full access for free when you go to dipsystories.com/pantsuit. That's dipsystories.com/pantsuit.
I recently reorganized my closet and realized that I never need to buy a white blouse or a blue dress again as long as I live. Guys, I have plenty. I did want to add some much neglected color, like pink and yellow, to my closet, and I knew just where to go. Quince always has timeless pieces and a true rainbow of options that can help you build a classic wardrobe no matter the season. It's getting warmer, so I got a soft pink chiffon pleated miniskirt that is so cute, and a really beautiful yellow cashmere tee. It's short-sleeved. It's perfect for the sort of bridge weather we're experiencing right now.
And the best part is all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices and premium fabrics and finishes. I absolutely love it. Get warm weather ready with Quince. Go to quince.com/pantsuit for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/pantsuit to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/pantsuit.
Sarah, a couple of times we've made sort of side references to our feelings about how birth is conducted in the United States and how it's talked about and the impact of that on feminism and issues of equality generally. And then we got a really nice email from a listener after the Affordable Care Act episode saying, hey, could you say more about that? And that's not the first time we've heard that question, so we'll do that today.
It's basically my favorite thing to talk about. I mean, birth is like more I really, really love talking about politics. But if I could do a podcast that just talked about birth, I guess I could. I mean, I just know they're stopping me. But it really is like one of my most favorite things to talk about.
I think before we start, because we both are on kind of the same track on this issue, we should say, I also think that we both are very much in the camp of women should do what women want to do, and bodies are your bodies. And, you know, I don't want anyone to feel disrespected by the choices that we made and that we talk about, and also by the way we talk about the information that women are given in this process. So nothing that we say is meant to insult anyone. It's just meant to bring to light some issues that I think we both feel really strongly about. And I also would say that if you aren't into birth and you maybe wouldn't listen to a podcast that was all about birth, hang with us, because I think that these issues really do have an impact on the cost of healthcare, and they really do have an impact on the way men and women relate to each other generally.
Absolutely. So I'll go, I mean, I'll just go first and talk a little bit about my personal journey. I actually was telling somebody this the other day. I think it started in college. I had a transy where we both attended school. We had a religion professor. I do not remember the class. I do not remember how he made birth work in the sort of context of this religion class, but his wife was really into home birth and natural birth. And we read a lot of, there's a really popular French doctor who sort of brought home birth back, and we read a lot. I think his name's Michel Odent. I think that's his name. I read a lot of his stuff, and it got me thinking about why we do the things we do in the United States in obstetrics, and if it's really the best sort of approach for women and children. And so that was like that planted the seed. And then the documentary Business of Being Born came out and really rocked my world. And I think when in college, I thought like, well, I'll just go to a birthing center. Like that sounded like the super safe, like the middle ground. Like you don't really want to have a baby in a hospital, so let's go to a birthing center. But once I saw Business of Being Born, I'm like, oh, heck, who needs a birthing center? I'll just have a baby at home. And I also had in law school, I had a torts professor who was really into medical error. And listen, you spend a couple like months studying medical errors, hospitals will not feel like safe places to you. So I think that was the other sort of brick in the wall. And so I got pregnant in D.C. and was going to a home birth clinic with some midwives, and then moved back to Kentucky, which is not a home birth friendly state. We're working on changing that law right now. But was lucky enough to find an amazing midwife who serves primarily the Amish and Mennonite communities around where I live. And I'll never forget, I was on the phone with her and I was like, well, are you going to do this? Do you make me do this? Do I have to do this? And she said, honey, you can do whatever you want, but I'm not going to make you do anything. And I thought, sold, that's who I want my baby. So I had Griffin in May of 2009. He was 9 pounds and 7 ounces. I gave birth to him at my mother's house. I had Amos 2 years later at my mother's house. with the same midwife. And then my darling Felix, 3.5 years later, in a snowstorm. So my midwife could not get out of her house. And so I actually had Felix at a hospital 16 minutes after I got there. He was delivered by the head nurse. And then I rolled out 5 hours later. I was like, peace out. Give me those against medical advice. I'm leaving. And I signed all the sheets and I left. And it was a fine, positive experience. I didn't have it, except for the nurse who kept trying to give me an IV as my baby was crowning, which I was like, you have to stop that. I can't take it. But other than that, it was a positive experience, and they were all 9 pounds. And it, you know, birth, having a natural home birth was really one of the most positive experiences of my life. I tell people I so often talk to friends who had had birth, and it felt like they talked like they'd survived a battle, like survived a war, like they were sort of traumatized. And I did not want to feel like that. I did not want to go into motherhood feeling like I had been, you know, not empowered, but just overwhelmed and beaten down. And so when I had Griffin, I felt totally empowered and totally, and that's where I think you get into the sort of the feminist and political aspects. I wasn't treated like I was ill. I wasn't treated like I didn't know what I was doing. That my body was sort of the enemy that needed to be tamed, or I don't even know what. I gave birth to my son standing firmly on my own 2 feet, and that's not a metaphor, I really was. And I just felt very empowered by the whole experience, and I couldn't have asked for a better way to enter motherhood. And I'm a huge advocate. I don't, like I said, I mean, if a hospital is a place that you feel safe, I think as long as you are in a situation in which, you know, I had a friend who really wanted a natural birth and ended up with a C-section, but she had an experience in which she felt like she advocated for herself. She was listened to. Her wishes were met every step of the way. And so I expected to go, she wanted a natural birth so badly. I expected to go talk to her and like to find her kind of deflated and sad, and it was such an amazing thing to see her. Like, it really opened my eyes to the situation. Like, it's about feeling like you can advocate for yourself, feeling like you're being heard, and that's really what it's about. And she felt that way, even though the outcome was not what she wanted. And she, you know, sort of was really in a positive place as she started that parenting journey.
Well, I had 2 hospital births. Mostly because I wanted to respect my husband's very strong preference about having our children in hospitals. And I have told him maybe 10% jokingly that I'll try not to always resent that, because I definitely did not want to have our babies in hospitals. And it was a fight all the way to have the kind of experience I wanted to have. So with our first daughter, Jane, who is 5.5 now, I was late, which I, you know, kind of resented the idea that they even knew I was late. You know, I thought, you're just guessing, you don't know, you know. And week 42 rolled around, and I could just tell by the way my OB was talking to me that in his mind we were already in a C-section situation. And I thought, as badly as I did not want to be induced, I felt that if I was not induced, he would just have this bias that took us down a path that I did not want to go down. And so I very reluctantly agreed at week 42 to have Pitocin. I negotiated that situation with my OB as though it were a legal contract. And I said to him, I will walk out still pregnant. So just be aware that I'm not going to have a C-section, just in the sense of like, get this baby out. If she's healthy and I'm healthy and it doesn't happen today, then it doesn't happen today. And bear in mind, like, I was miserable. Like, 42 weeks pregnant is an unhappy place to be, but that's where I was. And so I went into the hospital. It took 6 hours of increasing my dosage every 15 minutes to start labor. And once it started, it was on. And I had my daughter very quickly after that. I think it was maybe 3 or 4 hours, but it passed in what felt like 10 minutes to me. I did not have an epidural. It was very intense.
There's special ribbons for people who get through Pitocin without epidurals, because that's a whole nother ball game.
It was definitely a ball game. And at one point, there was one moment when I thought, I don't know if I can do this. And I sort of, in the corner of my mind, heard a nurse saying that the contractions were too close together and that they should probably turn the Pitocin down. And I remember yelling, turn it off. Like, it's happening. We're here. You know? And then after that, it was fine. And Jane was 10 pounds. And it was fine. You know, I was a little bit mad with both of my daughters, but I was happy to have felt everything that happened. I felt good after she was born. I felt like, I think people must feel after running a marathon,
yeah,
you know, like tired, but accomplished and super proud of myself, and lots of good chemicals, you know, surging through my body to get me through the beginning of motherhood. Somewhat similar situation with my second daughter. And talking to my maternal grandmother, I realize now that I think I just have a longer gestation period. You know, that's a thing. And yeah, it's not accounted for in our cute little iPhone pregnancy apps. But I think that was going on with me. But anyway, I was late again. I did go into labor naturally, but very, very slowly. And then we got into the situation of water broke and what, you know, it hasn't happened yet. And my blood pressure started going up with all that conversation. And then I said, you know, my blood pressure is going up because I hate this hospital and I hate all of you people. And I don't, I just want you to leave me alone. But nonetheless, they started freaking out. And so I'm having contractions and they're actually trying to draw blood from me.
Yep. I mean,
worst experience of my life.
I literally said, you have to stop. I can't do that right now.
They finally did stop. I mean, I was so upset and frustrated. I walked into the bathroom. I said to my husband, like, let's just lock the door and have the baby in here. I can't take it anymore with all of these people. But, the doctor then came in and started talking about inducing because of concerns about my blood pressure. And Sarah, I have never in my life so lost my nuance. Let me just tell you, I was so mad. And I just decided, like, I'm pushing this baby out right now. And I did. And the doctor was shocked. And I feel a little sad that she came into the world in a fit of rage. But that's where I was. And so Ellen, who is now 10 months old and wonderful, was 9 pounds and 10 ounces. And also born without any kind of drugs. And so, again, like, good experience in terms of, like, how my body worked for me and how I feel like my baby and I worked together. And another fight with the hospital. It's just, it's amazing to me how much wisdom you have as a woman in this situation and how flatly ignored that wisdom can be in conventional medical settings. And look, I had, in both cases, OBs who are known as, like, the natural birth OBs in Cincinnati. Like, this community is a small one, and I had the best, and it was still a battle.
Yeah. I mean, what I tell people is that it's such a different experience to have a baby at home because, you know, my midwife, first of all, she's clearly passionate about natural birth, she's basically committing a felony. She's practicing medicine without a license because in Kentucky they don't hand out licenses to home birth midwives. But again, working to change that law. And so we'll leave information about that in the show notes if you're in Kentucky and you'd like to get call your legislator and be supportive of this change, which would be fantastic. But she, you know, her kids are grown. Her husband's a truck driver. I remember right before I had Griffin, they said, you need to have a midwife who's had delivered about 300 babies because at that point you've seen everything. And Griffin was like her 300th baby. And at this point, I mean, Amos was born only 2 years later and she was up to like 500. I don't even know how many babies she's delivered at this point. It's a lot. And, you know, she comes when I go into labor. She stays until I have the baby. She stays for hours later. She comes back to my house to check on me. She doesn't have an agenda at all. Like, there's no hospital policy to worry about or nurses changing shifts or trying to get home, or she's on me and the baby's clock. And it's just a very different experience. You know, even when I had Felix, they were trying to get me to wait for my doctor to show up and I laughed in their faces. Like, I don't know why they call it pushing. It's not pushing. The baby's leaving. That's what's happening. The baby's going to leave. now.
Well, yeah, when you haven't
I couldn't stop that train
any,
if you wanted me to.
That's right. When you haven't had any pain medication, I mean, I've never had it, so I don't know what the sensation's like in that respect, but there are no choices, right?
No.
Like your body is just doing its thing.
It's going to do its thing. Get out of the way.
You're there.
Yeah. And so, you know, she's just I always tell people, like, if my midwife said, go jump off the roof, I'd be like, okay, where's the ladder? That's what I'll go do now. Like, I just trust her so implicitly. I know that she has nothing but me and the baby's health and safety in mind. And just sort of, there's just no other. And I don't think that means that, you know, OBGYNs, some of my dearest friends are OBGYNs in this town, and I just adore them. I think they do a great job. But they have other factors to consider. They just do. And that doesn't make them a bad person. It just means that they've got other things weighing on their decision-making. And so when she comes and she's just by my side until it happens, it's just a very different experience. I didn't have to sort of, I was just zen the whole time. I didn't really the only time I remember thinking with Griffin, I remember thinking, like, looking out the window, because it was like 10 in the morning when my labor started, and I thought, if it gets dark, I'm going to feel discouraged. Like, that's the only thought I remember having. Like, if the sun sets and I'm still here trying to have this baby, it's going to feel frustrating. But it didn't. He was born at like 3:30 or something. But, you know, that's all. I could just really stay in the zone and not worry about time and not worry about people asking me questions or changing my, or trying to put an IV in my arm. And like, there was nothing else I had to think about except for just listening to what my body was telling me. And doing that and moving in the where I wanted to go. And, you know, it was an incredibly positive experience. And I think where the political comes into play here is there is a lot of treating birth as sort of an illness or a pathology to be fixed and to be solved. And I do think there's feminist aspects of that. I think there is aspects of women's roles and women's bodies not being respected and being seen as something to sort of, you know, control and create a framework for and plug them through. That's that article that we put in the ACA, and we'll put it again, Atul Gawande's, which links it all to the APGAR score, which is once they could have these numbers to really grade what was happening, that's when things really started to change and you really wanted the outcome was all that mattered. Like I tell the story. I had a friend who had a really wanted a natural birth and had a C-section, and I just met her. I hadn't seen her in many years, and we were at a baby shower, and she said, "I know all that matters is the healthy baby." And I said, "You know, I don't think that. It's not that I don't think the healthy baby matters. I'm like, of course it matters, but it's not the only thing that matters. You feel traumatized by your experience. You wanted one thing and you didn't feel listened to and you didn't feel like you got the experience you wanted. And that's important too." And she burst into tears at this baby shower and was like, "Oh my God, thank you so much." Like, she just didn't feel listened to, and she didn't feel like she came in and was, you know, she had the experience she wanted. And there's just this very way that a lot of people talk about birth. And I think that they're sold sort of a bill of goods of, you know, just get in there, slap in the epidural, you know, all that matters is a healthy baby. I just think there's so much more going on with regards to the hormones and how it affects your emotions and how it affects your recovery. And there's a whole, not to mention the whole other aspect of this, which is we put women through massive medical traumas and then hand them a newborn and are like, "See you later. Have fun. Good luck with all that." You know, we know there's not a lot of post birth support in this society either, which is a huge problem as well.
Yeah, I think that the emphasis on the healthy baby is fine as long as you acknowledge that part of what a healthy baby needs to remain healthy is mm-hmm. a healthy, happy mother mm-hmm. and a mother who is equipped as much as you can be for the really difficult emotional work of mothering a newborn.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. So to the point about the after I had both of my girls, you know, in the hospital, you just continuously getting this question about your pain. And I was prepared for that because I took an excellent birth course where they said, hey, the hospital is going to constantly ask you about your pain, and that's going to get into your head unless you tell them to stop asking. And so I did stop asking. I did tell them to stop asking during labor, but then afterward, you know, can you rate your pain 1 to 10? And I just like had
four. I don't know how you rate pain. I just don't know how you rate pain.
Well, it's so annoying. I mean, I finally said to one nurse, I am not in pain. I'm uncomfortable. I am super uncomfortable. Yeah. I'm not in pain. And they asked me if I wanted pain medicine, even though I wasn't complaining of pain. I took some Advil or something, you know. But then I left the hospital with my second child. So this was just 10 months ago. I'm not talking about like the distant past. I get home and I have this folder of stuff, right? And it's more just condescending, obnoxious crap about caring for the baby. And, you know, I hope that's helpful to someone, but it annoyed me. So I'm going through it and I find in it a prescription and I'm like, that's weird. And I pull the prescription out. It has my name on it, so it wasn't somebody else's. It is a prescription for Vicodin, and it's been prescribed for me by a doctor I never met while I was in the hospital. Wow. And I thought, you have to be kidding me. I mean, my husband and I joked about, like, why don't we just get it and sell it? And then we, you know, we'll have all the money that we need to raise this baby. You know, we tore it up and put it in the trash. But I thought, like, how dangerous is this to send someone home who has no pain with this prescription? What if I were having some kind of postpartum depression situation? You know, what kind of outcomes could have happened through this unnecessary and, in my view, like really irresponsible prescription from someone who never evaluated me? Like, what's going on there?
Yeah, no, totally.
And so when you think about the cost of healthcare, right? One, we're getting treatment often that we don't need or want because of whatever protocol doctors are paying attention to. I do think we have to ask ourselves about tort law here too, because as much as I believe in the right of someone who's been wronged to seek redress for that wrong, we're in a situation where concern about liability is jeopardizing outcomes, not improving them. And then we have an unnecessary prescription happening in who knows how many situations leading to potential addictions. I mean, what are we doing here?
Yeah. Well, and when I studied that in our that tort law class where we really focused on medical malpractice and medical errors and what that means. I mean, it's such the truth is you have these suits to as best you can help the person who has been harmed, but they don't really affect the medical community in any real, like they don't change anything. They don't reduce medical errors. They don't change policy for the most part. So I think that's, you know, something to always remember. As far as costs with particularly associated with birth, I can tell you that what my midwife charged me for Griffin's birth was $1,600. Now, I think that was only for half of it. I think it was $1,600. And that was every visit, every prenatal visit, not including 2 weeks of postpartum care after he was born. She would come to the house and check on me. And, you know, she noticed with Amos when I was starting to have a little postpartum depression, she was way too ready to, you know, sort of interact with me in a way that I don't think most doctors would be, just because when I would go see my midwife, it wasn't, I would go sit like I would, what I would see an OBGYN. I would go in to her little clinic and she would come to my house and we're talking like an hour and a half of me and her talking. How's your diet? How are you feeling? Where are you uncomfortable? What's this? What are you worried about? Like it was total care, a real total care in a way that I don't think happens very often in the traditional hospital setting. And so when Amos came along and I was, you know, still trying to take my 2-year-old to library story time and be super mom while I had this newborn, not a good plan. Don't do that, y'all. Skip it. Doesn't work out well. She was really great about sort of noticing, like, you're doing too much. You're pushing yourself too hard. You've got to chill out. And really intervening, I think that in a way it could have gotten much, much worse. So then I had Felix, And I believe the bill for his birth at the hospital, and we got there at 3 a.m. I had him 16 minutes later, and we left, I think, at about maybe 9 after the pediatrician saw him. We checked ourselves out at like 9. So about 6 hours. That was $6,000. That was the bill from the hospital. I never moved to another room. I didn't go to recovery. I did take a shower, which they were, you know, sort of dumbfounded. Because most people, she said, most people have an epidural and they can't walk. So we don't really know if the shower even works. Great. Well, I want to take a shower. So, you know, it was a huge expense where I think for several hours in the hospital, whereas with my midwife, you had a total care package for a sixth of the cost. So, you know, I think that I really wish we would come around to, and home birth's not for everybody, but for the people who want that model of care, who are low risk and are qualified to have it, it could be such a savings, a cost savings in our healthcare industry. Listen, y'all, let's be serious. I'm 42 years old. Of course, I take my skincare routine seriously. There are a lot of daily skincare products on the market claiming to help reduce fine lines and wrinkles, but how do you know your products are actually working? Well, Ritual is here for you. They have Hyacera, their once daily skin supplement, clinically proven to reduce wrinkles and fine lines and increase skin smoothness in 90 days. They conducted a clinical study and it led to a 3.6 times reduction in crow's feet within 90 days as compared to a placebo and a 2.9 times increase in skin smoothness within 90 days as compared to a placebo. I love taking my Hyacera every day as part of my skincare routine instead of just slathering more products on my face. It feels like I'm doing something from the inside out. And their one daily capsule is essenced with soothing vanilla, so it's a very pleasant experience. Start Hyacera to help minimize wrinkles without compromising on clean science. Hyacera from Ritual is a clinically proven skin supplement you can actually trust. Get 25% off your first month for a limited time at ritual.com/pantsuit. Start Ritual or add Hyacera to your subscription today. That's ritual.com/pantsuit for 25% off.
Do you want a bra that's sexy or a bra that's comfortable? Thanks to Third Love, you can have both. Third Love was started to take all the frustration, ick, and ugh out of bra shopping. That's why they made solutions for every bra problem, aka problems. Their bras make it easy to bring back perkiness you haven't seen since high school, get smoothing you know where, and have straps that actually stay put. Designed at their headquarters in San Francisco and made from premium materials, they put every style through hours of wear testing on real women, including themselves, before it's given the stamp of boob approval. Comfort and support are guaranteed. Plus, whether you're a AA cup or an H cup, their virtual fitting room will help you find your perfect fit fast. They even invented half cups. No more feeling stuck between two cup sizes that don't fit. It's time to get your problem solved. Visit thirdlove.com and get 15% off your order with code PODCAST15.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Well, and the thing that I really want to emphasize in terms of the politics of all this is that I think this is a scenario in the most basic way where women are told that the most fundamental things about being women are not a match for the perspective of men. Mm. I mean, and I don't mean to be ugly about that. This is a conversation I've had with my husband a number of times. As much as I love him and know that his perspective on birth comes from a good place of wanting to take care of me, it does really anger me that I respected his opinion about the hospital more than I respected my own perspective, which was sort of, I'm a mammal and I can do this. Mammals are made to do this. And I will say that, like, if you need sort of a mantra, if you're pregnant and you're trying to get through that, like, that helped me a lot just to kind of remember, like, we're built for this. We are made to do this. Every instinct that we have, whatever path you choose, right? If you want to get an epidural, do it. That's fine with me. But just remember, like, you're built for this. You can do it. You're made for it. There's nothing to fear here, right? And I think that our culture has told us, be afraid of this. It's hard. You're too weak to get through it, so we'll help you. And it makes me upset. And I think about how powerful I felt after the birth of both of my daughters and how much knowledge I gained just kind of in this really innate way. It's almost like instantly I knew things that I hadn't known before about myself and about life and about just the meaning of things generally. And I think about how many women have not had that experience because they were being unnecessarily tended to. Now, look, thank goodness for medical intervention where it's needed. You know, hallelujah that we have the tools that we need to help people when they need that help. But we're helping people when they don't need that help, and that is not help. And I feel like our culture would be completely different if we honored women's intuition and power around birth. I really do.
Well, and I have to say, you know, I've noticed this over and over again. This is mad props to our shout out to our executive producer, a.k.a. my husband, Nicholas Holland, because he really, I think he had concerns, but I'm sort of a freight train when I get my mindset on something. And he was like, you know what? You want to do this? We'll do it. And my mom, actually, the funniest thing is my mom was like, I was born via C-section. And my mom was like, no, this is a terrible idea. You were born via C-section. Everyone will die if we do this. And we watched and my grandmother was sort of the same way, in that we watched The Business of Being Born with my grandmother and my mother. And it was a totally fascinating experience because, you know, they go through the history of obstetrics, particularly in America. And so my grandmother had 3 children that were actually my mother and my uncle were breech. Her first child and her second child were breech. She had them vaginally but she had twilight birth. So they knocked her out. She has no memory of it. And so to watch her perspective on the history where they talk about twilight birth and then they talk about C-sections. They talk about, you know, that a lot of C-sections happen like at 3:30 at the end of the shift, which is when I was born. And my mom, like watching sort of, my mom had been telling herself this narrative my whole life, which is I wouldn't put my head down and it was sort of my fault and that's why she couldn't give birth to me. And she's watching this movie and like 30 minutes into the movie, she's like, okay, you can have the home birth here. I'm convinced. But then we kind of continue to watch it and she's like, oh my God, like I remember wanting to walk around and they wouldn't let me walk around. I remember just thinking like, if you let me move, I feel like I could do this, but they wouldn't let her get out of bed. And she's like, oh my God, you were born at 3:30, that you were born at the end of the shift. Like just watching these sort of realizations wash over her. Because listen, the reality for me talking about birth is I've had 2 home births. I've given birth to 3 babies naturally. They were all over 9 pounds. So I bring up a lot of stuff in people when I tell my story. And what I tell people and what, you know, kind of what I say is, The reality of the situation is in America and in certain states, the C-section rate is 40%, upwards, sometimes lower, sometimes even higher, and it should be around 16%. So people are getting C-sections they do not need. Nobody wants to think they're the person that got the C-section they did not need, although I have a friend of mine who I tell her we're the perfect tag team because she will say, like, I did not need my C-section. This is where I went wrong. And, like, we're sort of an interesting side-by-side comparison. But, like, you know, we kind of have to acknowledge that and we have to say everyone should be empowered. And, yes, no one should feel guilty for what they chose or what happened to them. But if we're going to have an honest conversation about the state of obstetrics in America, we have to acknowledge that people are getting C-sections they do not need statistically, not because of our diverse population or any of that. Like mathematically, it's not going to put a dent in the difference between where the C-section should be according to the World Health Organization and where it is. So, you know, we have to talk about this, and there's so much emotion tied up in how you become a parent and how you give birth. And, you know, we have to sort of find a nuanced way to talk about this without judging each other. You know, I have dear friends who chose elective C-sections 3 times. They're not any worse mothers than I am in any stretch of the imagination. And I'm not a better mother because I had natural birth. We kind of have to set all that aside and just talk openly. But I think it's really that the politics of it is so difficult because, like you said, there's just so much tied up in how people talk about their own bodies. And, you know, everybody think it's sort of like, I feel like the way people talk about women in politics. You know, everybody thinks their position on, like, maybe whether they should run, sort of, I think about it the way I think about when I watched Raising Miss President for the first time. I thought all these thoughts were just my internal, totally unique personal opinions of my life and my experiences. But y'all, we're all affected by this. No matter how much you feel like, well, this is just what matters to me. What matters to you is affected by our culture, by what we're, the lessons we're given about what a woman's body should look like, what a woman's body should do, what a woman's body should be used for or by. Like, those affect all of us. And I think a birth is a really interesting political space to see that message and to see the cultural values we hold about motherhood and women and our bodies come to fruition. And we all want to think it's this complete, because it is, the paradox is true. It is both an incredibly personal journey full of personal decisions that affect the very soul and heart of a person becoming a parent for the first time, like all that. But it's also wrapped up in huge cultural messages and societal values and political issues. They are both true. It is a space where both coexist, and that's why it's so fraught, but it's also why it's so important.
And I think on both levels, it begins at birth, because for me, the power of having given birth and fully experiencing every aspect of that and advocating for myself in the medical context really set the stage for me to make the decisions that I have made since as a mother. And, you know, we've talked before how I don't do mom guilt. I think that started from just this innate sense of like, I got this. I know what I'm doing. You know, I don't need a bunch of guidance. What works for me isn't going to be for everybody, but it's going to work for me and it's all going to be fine. And I just think that we really have to support women in connecting mm-hmm. with that sense of wisdom from the beginning instead of telling them that it doesn't exist.
Yeah, absolutely.
Since we're doing the mom thing, we're going to move on in the heels to talking about transportation of families.
Stay with us. We're going full mom.
Sarah, you're a minivan person, and I understand that you feel strongly about this.
I feel very strongly. I don't really like to hold any opinions that I don't hold strongly. No, I'm sure there's some things I feel neutral about. Just minivans is not one of them. I really love my minivan, and I recently got a new minivan. We bought our old minivan. It was like a 2005. It had 1,000,000 miles on it because we were adding a second car, so we didn't want to like blow the bank. But the transmission died, and I got a brand new one. And I love my minivan, and I feel that everyone with small children not driving a minivan is suffering unnecessarily. And I understand you're in that group of people, Beth.
I do not feel that I'm suffering, though, I have to say.
Sorry, I'm just telling you right now.
Well, I'm not anti-minivan. I am neutral as to minivans. But for me, I chose a small SUV. I had a car. I drove an Altima when Jane was a baby, but when we were pregnant with our second child, I got a small SUV. I love my SUV very, very much. It is not particularly roomy, but it is so easy to get in and out of. It's so easy to park. I went a little bit overboard in buying a nicer car than I ever thought that I would buy. Let me just tell you how that was worth every single dollar I spent. Because I spend so much time in the car that having a car that I enjoy is a big deal for me, and also kind of helps me get over some of my issues with cars that I just have because of life experiences. It's a wonderful thing, and it works with my kids, and it works for groceries and all the things that I need to do. So I don't feel like I'm missing out on anything from the minivan with my small SUV. I definitely feel that I suffered in my Altima now that I have like that frame of reference of like being up a little bit higher and dealing with car seats and strollers and stuff. It was, we were really pushing it with the car and the children.
The key with the minivan, the reason the minivan is paradise if you have children, it really doesn't have to do with the like my friend, I think she just got a Pilot or something, and she has all these nice options. That's great. It's not about like the DVD and all the stuff they put in there, although I really do wish I had one of the ones with the vacuum. That would be nice. But it's the sliding doors. I don't know how my life would work if I mean, I don't know how many times a day I let Amos in the car, but I don't ever have to walk over to that side. I open the door for him. Him and Griffin get in. They strap themselves in. I close the door. Like, I'm holding Felix. I'm trying to keep Amos from running in traffic. I don't have to open a door, then walk around and open another door. I press the buttons. I put my kids in. I get in the car. I close the buttons. I mean, it's all about the automatic sliding doors. And my friend Elizabeth makes a good point, which is you also, as they get older, don't have to worry about them banging the doors into other people's cars, which I hadn't even thought about yet. It's the sliding door, people. That's the key to happiness.
Well, thanks for joining us for another episode. I know that this one was a little bit out there, but we appreciate you coming on board with us. Next Tuesday, I think, Sarah, we're going to talk about how to talk to Donald Trump supporters. Is that our plan?
Either that, or we might have some guests. The scheduling is still up in the air. And hopefully I'll have some good news to report about my election. Hello.
Yes, we're all sending you good vibes this Tuesday when Kentucky votes. So go Holland for Paducah. You can, as always, visit our website, pantsuitpoliticsshow.com. Get a t-shirt before they're gone, which is going to be really soon. Follow us on Twitter at Pantsuit Politic, on Facebook at Pantsuit Politics. Just reiterating our plea for iTunes reviews. We really appreciate those, and they really help us out, y'all. And until next time, keep it nuanced, y'all.